So, what's up, Betamaxers? Welcome once again to Celluloid Fever Dreams, a weekly dive into cinematic history, trying to find the overlooked and underappreciated films that more people should be aware of. As always, I'm your host, the looker, the hooker, the guy who can't think of another word that ends in ooker, Wyndham Jennings. This week, we're going back to 1982 for a movie musical based on a Broadway musical, based on an actual real-life incident that also inspired a classic rock hit from one of my favorite bands. Confused yet? Don't worry, it's not that confusing. This week, we're talking about The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. Hey, look at that. It's the return of the theme song. I've been, toying with the idea of bringing it back full time and decided since this is such a special episode, I'd give it another shot. If you listened to last week's episode, you know I said that I was going to talk about the movie Stockholm, and I intend to do that movie. It'll probably be next week's episode, but I couldn't let this episode number go by without doing, in my mind, an appropriate movie for it, because this is episode 69, and yes, I'm still a 14-year-old at heart, I guess. You know, but still, considering I want to keep the podcast in around the PG level in terms of content, well, in terms of how I address the content, I really couldn't think of a better film to go along with that kind of attitude than Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, starring Burt Reynolds, Dolly Parton, Dom DeLuise, and Jim Nabors. Now, rewatching this film for the podcast, it kind of reminded me of the fact that I'm old enough to have seen this in theaters. And I did see this in theaters because for my parents, a child's ticket was cheaper than a babysitter. And in fact, I probably should start a whole letterboxed list around films that I saw way too young. Because if we didn't see it in theaters, well, once it was available on home video, well, I watched it then because we only had the one TV and the one VCR. Yeah, so just off the top of my head, I can remember seeing Porky's, Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, Jaws 2, one of the Clint Eastwood and Orangutan movies. I can't remember if it was Any Which Way But Loose or Any Which Way You Can. But I saw one of them in theaters, I remember. That could almost be an interesting series for the podcast, movies I saw long before I should have. As always, we start with our copyrighted 2-second synopsis. Sexy singing stuff happens. A little bit of a longer synopsis. Crusading morality reporter Melvin P. Thorpe takes it upon himself to shut down the Chicken Ranch, a Texas institution and brothel that is located just outside of the small town of Gilbert, Texas. Opposed by local sheriff Ed Earl Dodd and the madam of the brothel, Miss Mona Stangley, and literally just about everybody else in town who don't see anything wrong with having the Chicken Ranch out there to begin with, he tries to win the war of public opinion, despite Miss Mona's insistence that, well, there's nothing dirty going on. You know, I gotta say, I do like a good tagline for a film, and this one doesn't have it. The only tagline I could come across for the movie was, "With Burt and Dolly, this much fun should be illegal." And, you know, really, like, that's the best you could come up with for this movie? Now, like I said earlier, the 1982 film is based on a 1978 Broadway play, which is based on an actual incident, or I guess I should say series of incidents, that led to the closure of the actual Chicken Ranch outside of LaGrange, Texas, in 1973. And, you know, kind of like the episode we did a few weeks back on the death of Stalin, where some of the more outrageous elements in the story turned out to be, you know, based on actual incidents, this film kind of follows the same path. A lot of the things that I'm watching the movie and thinking, oh, you know, it's just kind of silly or a little bit of goofy humor, is actually based on things that happened in the early 70s in the story that they're retelling in the play and the film. And besides this movie, the actual Chicken Ranch also inspired the 1973 song LaGrange by Texas natives ZZ Top, of which there are three members, one of whom has the last name Beard, and it's the one guy who doesn't have a beard. Stories told in flashback by Sheriff Fred, the current sheriff of the county, and in the flashback, he's Deputy Fred, working for Sheriff Earl Ed Nod. He gives a brief history on the Chicken Ranch, like how it got its name and how long it had been around, and then goes on to tell the story of how this reporter out of Houston shut the thing down. And I actually went to the LaGrange site, the city site, and I clicked on their history and got to read the history of it, and it is fairly close to what it is in the film. In on the actual site, they talk about that prostitution had been in the county since 1844, and that before its closure in 1973, the Chicken Ranch was the oldest continually operating non-floating whorehouse in the United States. And non-floating doesn't mean that they didn't use a boat. It just means that there was a fixed location rather than the girls standing on street corners or, you know, showing up to another location in order to do their business with their customers. The Chicken Ranch got its name both in the film and in real life. And yes, I'm going to give you a brief history of the Chicken Ranch because that's, I don't know, to me it's just sort of interesting how close the movie got to it. Got its name because during the Depression, when people didn't have a whole lot of money, the founder of it, Miss Jessie Williams, who bought the land and the house in 1915, started charging, quote, one chicken for one screw. And they wound up with so many chickens that they started a side business of selling meat, chickens, and eggs. And in fact, on the county tax rolls, the place was listed as a poultry farm. Another little bit of tongue-in-cheek to give you an idea of how people felt about having a brothel just outside of town. In the 1950s, the local phone book even included a picture of chickens outside of a farm on their cover, in a move that a lot of locals say was a nice little nod and wink to the ranch and the girls out there. In the 50s, Miss Jessie's health started to decline, and one of the girls, Miss Edna Milton, took over, buying the ranch and the land around it, all 11 acres, for about $30,000, which was well above what the land was worth in those days. In fact, the only thing that she changed once she took over was she spent the money to put air conditioning in. Now, the thing is, much like in the film, if you just drove by, it just looked like a farmhouse. The entrance to the brothel was in the back. They didn't do any kind of advertising. They didn't have any signs that led you out there to the place and told what it was. You know, locals just knew and would basically direct you out there. And it was a popular place. It was estimated by some that at its peak, which would be like the mid to late 60s, the Chicken Ranch was bringing in $500,000 a year, or roughly $4.5 million adjusted to today's rates. Now, if you're wondering how they was able to stay in business so long before this reporter turned public opinion against them, well, there were a few things that sort of helped them along. For one thing, one of the rules is no drinking on the premises. No drinking, no drugs. The girls got sent once a week to town in order to get a medical checkup. They were also not allowed to fraternize with anybody in town. In other words, they pretty much stayed on the ranch to themselves, which kind of helped. No feelings getting involved, nobody getting jealous. Though everything they bought was local. Like, they needed new dresses, makeup, groceries, whatever. They would buy them locally. On top of that, both Miss Edna and Miss Jessie were very active in local community events. They would, give to charities, give to the churches, support people that needed help, et cetera, et cetera. Philanthropic, buying things that the schools needed, et cetera. And probably the biggest thing is, one, they never allowed criminals to work there. In other words, when you applied to work at the chicken ranch, you got sent to town where the sheriff would photograph you, fingerprint you, do a background check, and if you had a previous record, well, you weren't allowed to work there. If you had any outstanding warrants, then you were taken in. And on top of that, if the girls or Miss Edna heard anything of an illegal nature from any of their customers, they would pass it along to the local police. In fact, one sheriff even bragged that during his whole career, there was not a single unsolved crime in the entire county, thanks to the chicken ranch. And all that came to a screeching halt in the early 70s, thanks to Marvin Zindler, a reporter from KTRK in Houston, who, and this is again from the official LaGrange site, quote, decided he needed to make a name for himself by bringing down the chicken ranch, claiming it was linked to organized crime and corruption. And the reason I wanted to read that is because that's such a Southern turn of phrase, decided to make a name for himself. It's one of those phrases kind of like, and if you're not from the South, you may not catch this sometimes, but kind of like the phrase, bless their heart, which if you're Southern and you hear somebody say, oh, yeah, Jimmy did this, bless his heart, you understand they're saying Jimmy's the stupidest person that's ever lived, and that was the dumbest decision he could have ever made in his life. And this is another one of those phrases. Anytime you hear somebody named, and this followed up with a phrase, decided to go out and make a name for himself or herself, what it roughly translates it to is, this here idiot decided to go out and ruin a good thing for everyone. And the story of the ranch got so, and Marvin shutting it down, got such attention, national attention, that the articles that were written about it were adapted into a play by author Larry L. King and Peter Masterson. Music and lyrics for the play was written by Carol Hall, and as I said, it made its Broadway debut in 1978. It was directed by Peter Masterson, and Tommy Toon, who handled the choreography. Tommy Toon, a world-famous choreographer and dancer. And in fact, when it was being adapted into a film, both Masterson and Tommy Toon were attached to be the directors of the film. The studio, however, didn't have a whole lot of confidence in Masterson and Toon being able to pull off the movie because they had no filmmaking experience. So they handed it over to writer-director Colin Higgins, who had previously worked with Dolly Parton on her debut film, 9 to 5, and also written the films Foul Play, Silver Streak, and Harold and Maude. Yeah, I'm kind of sad to say I have not seen Harold and Maude yet. It's one of those films that people keep recommending to me, but I never sat down and watched it yet. According to some sources, Miss Edna was a silent partner in the production of the play. Dolly Parton was brought on in order to play Miss Mona. This would be only her second acting job. Like I said, her debut was in 9 to 5. And I got to say, if you're not somewhere around my age or maybe around 40, it's kind of hard to really grasp how big Dolly Parton was in the 70s and 80s. No pun intended. Nowadays Dolly's known mainly for her own charity work, her own philanthropy, as well as her theme park, Dollywood, which of course also rose out of her good-natured heart as she bought it in order to bring jobs to the area of the country that she grew up in. But Parton herself is a living legend, and honestly, as a comedic actress, I liked her She hasn't done a whole lot of acting. Besides 9 to 5 and this, she's been in, as I mentioned last week, the film Rhinestone. She's in Steel Magnolias with Julia Roberts, Straight Talk, and she's had TV appearances in shows like Designing Women, Grace and Frankie, in which she teamed up again with Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda for a 9 to 5 reunion. And she also was Aunt Dolly, if you're a certain age, on Hannah Montana. Parton, of course, started out on the Porter Wagoner television show and did several albums with him as a duet, as well as doing some single work. In fact, the song I Will Always Love You, which she penned and was the original singer for, was written about the end of their professional relationship as she finally struck out on her own full-time. And honestly, with a voice like that, it's no surprise that she wound up being a multi-platinum selling artist. Her first record was in 1967, Hello, I'm Dolly. And I could honestly probably go the rest of this episode just listing off all of the things this woman has done in her career, but here's just a few highlights. She's tied with Reba McEntire for the most number one songs by a female country performer at 25. She's had 44 top 10 country albums, which is a record for any artist, 110 charted singles. She's won 11 Grammys, 10 Country Music Association Awards, 5 Academy of Country Music Awards, 4 People's Choice Awards, 3 American Music Awards. She is one of less than 100 people who have been nominated for an Academy Award, Grammy Award, Tony Award, and Emmy Award. She was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1999, and just earlier this year, she was nominated and then declined, and then they're going to induct her anyway into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, one of only a handful of artists who have made it into the Country Music Hall of Fame and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This woman is a living legend. And when asked in interviews about working on this movie, she has said that at times it was a nightmare. But I like her as Miss Mona. You know, it fits what Dolly was doing at the time. Like I said, she was a huge recording artist. She's breaking into film and television as an actress. And as a comedic actress, I really like her. And as a musical comedy, this role's perfect for her, especially Miss Mona. It works in with her natural sass, her timing. She gets to sing and show off this wonderful voice. In fact, they took out some of the songs from the play, and Dolly not only wrote new music for the movie, but she also included a couple of songs that she recorded before. You'll get to hear her do I Will Always Love You towards the end of the film. Yeah, so honestly, looking back, I cannot think of a better person at this point in history for this role than Dolly Parton. And of course, if you're going to have somebody like Dolly Parton, you need to have a huge star starring opposite of her. Somebody not only draw in the people to the box office to see the film, but somebody who acting-wise can hold themselves up and well-rounded enough that they can, you know, do the comedy bits and also, when it calls for it, you know, do the serious bits, because there are a few serious moments in the film as well. And of course, you got to go with the number one star at the time, which is Burt Reynolds as Sheriff Earl Ed Dodd. And yeah, I got to admit, the one thing that sort of hits me wrong when I'm watching the film is the fact that everybody calls him Earl Ed. And I don't know why, it doesn't hit my ear right. And of course, Earl Ed is Burt Reynolds, as I mentioned, who, honestly, a string of hits. If Dolly Parton was the biggest country star of the 70s and early 80s, Burt Reynolds was literally the biggest movie star of the same time. Just a small list of his films include Deliverance, White Lightning, The Longest Yard, Smokey and the Bandit, Semi-Tough, the Cannonball Run films, Hooper, Stroker Ace. For 5 years straight, from 1978 to 1982, he was the biggest box office draw in the world. It's a record that he tied with Bing Crosby. And to give you an idea of how big of a deal that is, some of the others that have made number five include Clint Eastwood, but he didn't do five consecutive, and Tom Cruise, who actually was number one for 6 years, but again, not consecutive. And I know some of you out there are probably wondering who number one is, And it's John Wayne with 25 appearances at the top of the, oh, I forgot to tell you guys, the Quigley Publications annual distributors poll for the biggest box office draw at theaters. And I love Burt Reynolds. I remember seeing the Smokey and the Bandit movies and just loving his attitude, that sort of, you know, cocky, almost kind of a jackass at times, but just that level of confidence and, you know, the wit about him. You know, it's hard not to watch those movies and root for him. And he always kind of projected, and it might be weird to say this, he always kind of projected, like, you got he's a movie star, but he also just seemed like somebody that you could just approach, and y'all might wind up just, you know, sharing a beer somewhere and swapping crazy stories about growing up, and you know what I mean? Just, he seemed like a natural, regular person, you know, and he had range. I mean, he could be that for Smokey and the Bandit. He could be, you know, more serious in films. You know, he could be an action star in things like Deliverance, White Lightning. He could be, you know, semi-tough, where he could combine the two. And, you know, later on in his career, you know, he came back sort of in the 90s with films like Striptease, Boogie Nights, for which he got an Academy Award. He has range, is what I'm trying to say, which is, I think, something that sort of gets forgotten when you see the films he's remembered for nowadays. I think more people know him, especially with Norm Macdonald doing the impersonations of him on Saturday Night Live as kind of the smart ass, you know, the sort of almost jerky kind of smart ass. And he had so much more range than that, and showed it through a lot of films, especially through the 70s and 80s. He did so many films that are overlooked. Like I said, Stroker Ace. He was doing NASCAR movies before Tom Cruise even had a film under his belt. You know, Best Friends. That's one that I probably need to see if I can find to do for the show. Best Friends, his romantic comedy with Goldie Hawn. But Burt and Dolly work well together. You know, Dolly Parton is such a big personality, even, you know, especially in this film. You know, you need somebody that oh God, I'm trying to think of a good way to say it. She's a little over the top, but you kind of expect that in a musical. I mean, it's not something that's, you know, a negative. Like I said, the film plays a lot to her strengths and her timing, and you know, sort of a wink and a nod. The audience kind of knows who she is and what kind of personality she has. So that works to her benefit, and it really helps having Burt Reynolds in there, because he can play off of it, and he can also draw her in sometimes when it needs to be. Like, he can add a little more weight to a scene that he needs to, but he can also match her in goofiness. So this is really a good pairing, I think, between the two of them. And I kind of wish they'd done a few more things together. I really do like them together. Though, again, I don't think Burt Reynolds really enjoyed the experience as much as you might have thought from watching them together on screen. Again, I could not film across any really juicy stories, but he did say in interviews, you know, by the time I got there, they were on the third director. And he said, some people thought that was my doing, but he says, Dolly was hired before me. And then when asked about what it was like to work with her, he said she's got a very self-deprecating personality in public. And again, that's all I could find on him talking about working on the movie. And I think one of the other things that works for the film is the fact that they teamed up Burt Reynolds once again with Dom DeLuise. And I will die on this hill. Burt Reynolds and Dom DeLuise together is one of the best comedic pairings of all time. You know, once again, Dom DeLuise, kind of like Dolly Parton, can go over the top. He can go broad. He can just be insanely funny. And there's some people who say that Dom DeLuise is at his best, that the only person who could really draw him out and get him to be his best was Mel Brooks. And I'm not going to argue with that. Mel Brooks can get the best out of a lot of people in terms of comedy. There's no argument. Mel Brooks is one of the best comedic directors of all time. And I'll agree with that. Some of the best work Dom DeLuise ever did was the films he did, like The 12 Chairs, Silent Movie, Spaceballs, etc., with Mel Brooks. but I would stand up so many, the films he did with Burt Reynolds as, again, some of the best work he ever did. They did six films together. Well, they appeared in seven films together. In six of them, they actually shared scenes together. They include a silent movie, in which they both appeared, but didn't share any scenes together. Cannonball Run 2, 1 and 2, Smokey and the Bandit 2, The End, and All Dogs Go to Heaven. And again, I think that's why he works so well with Dolly, because, like I said, Dom DeLuise can go big, and he can go funny, and he can go over the top, and almost cartoony, and Bert is there to sort of be straight man to a lot of that, sort of rein him in occasionally, but at the same time, you can also match him in goofiness sometimes. So it's a good pairing, and even though they're playing antagonists in this film, you can still sort of feel the chemistry between them. You know, the fact that they were such close friends off screen as well. You know, you can get the feeling that these are two guys that know what each other are capable of in these scenes, and are really well played against each other. You know, like there's a certain familiarity and comfort level there that I think brings out more in each one of them. And again, crazy enough, some of the more outrageous scenes between Earl Dodd and Melvin are actually based on real incidents. Like there's a scene where, Earl Ed cusses him out in the town square and they catch it on camera. That's based on a real incident in which the real sheriff of LaGrange, T.J. Flournoy, if I'm pronouncing that right, when he saw that Marvin had come down to do a follow-up to his story, confronted him in front of the courthouse and cussed him out and shoved him to the ground, which resulted in Zindler suing him for damages. And to give you an idea of what people thought about Zindler, the town started up a fund to pay for the sheriff's legal fees and also to pay off any settlement in case Zindler won. Give you an idea of how popular Zindler was in LaGrange. And in the movie, Ed Earl punches Melvin and yanks his wig off of his head at a later scene, which is supposedly based on a real incident. The actual sheriff said that he didn't touch him, he didn't yank his wig off, but some of the people who were there said that no, he did yank it off and waved the toupee around like it was some kind of victory flag. And considering all the principals involved in the dispute are dead at this point, we'll never really know the truth. Deputy Fred, well, Sheriff Fred, the one who's telling the story, starting from the beginning of the film, is Jim Nabors. And you either know Jim Nabors from the Andy Griffith Show, or you know him from the spinoff, Gomer Pyle, USMC. This is only his, believe it or not, this is only his second film role. He had done a lot of television, he'd done the Andy Griffith Show, he'd done Gomer Pyle, the spinoff, guest appearances on different variety shows. He had a very beautiful baritone singing voice. He actually wound up releasing 44 albums over the course of his career. And when you hear his speaking voice, it is kind of a revelation when you hear that singing voice come out. And I'm kind of disappointed they did not find a number in the story for him to sing, because I do enjoy Jim Nabors' voice. I enjoy the Andy Griffith Show too. I grew up on it. I'm not that old. I grew up on it in reruns, but honestly, I kind of hold the show up as an example of comedy done right, in that a lot of the comedy came from the characters and their beliefs and their outlooks more than just throwing wacky situations at everybody. And I mean, there was wacky situations, but honestly, Andy Griffith and Gomer Pyle, those two shows, I remember watching them in reruns as a kid, and even today I'll catch them on, well, catch Andy Griffith on, and I'll watch it and just find it hilarious. A couple of other movies you can catch Jim Nabors in include Stroker Ace, again with Burt Reynolds, and Cannonball Run 2, again with Burt Reynolds. Interesting little fact I uncovered while researching this film and researching Jim Nabors a little. As you know, Jim Nabors played Gomer Pyle, who was the original gas station attendant on The Andy Griffith Show. And in fact, Andy Griffith had seen Jim Nabors cabaret act. He would do, you know, his because he was originally from Alabama, I believe, but he would, you know, do some stand-up comedy, and he would sing, and Andy Griffith just thought he was perfect for the show, and then Gomer got so popular, they spun him off into the, you know, Gomer went off and joined the Marines, and that became Gomer Pyle USMC, but he was replaced by his cousin Goober, who I can't think of the name of the actor, who took over running the gas station. Over the entire course of the Andy Griffith Show and Gomer Pyle USMC, the cousins, Jim Nabors and the other guy, you know, Gomer and Goober, only had three scenes together. Only appeared in an episode three times together. Once on the Andy Griffith Show, once on Gomer Pyle, and then it would be 1986, and I believe the movie, TV movie, Return to Mayberry, when the two actors, who, again, are supposed to be playing cousins, would actually appear in a scene together. And, you know, and honestly, I like Jim Nabors, and I think he's a good fit for the film. He's not in a huge role, but I also feel like he's probably, acting-wise, the weakest of the cast, because Jim Nabors just plays Jim Nabors in every role he ever does. You know, the hick voice, the kind of like childlike, well, I'm going to say childlike, just sort of the naive kind of person, you know, the sort of innocent person, personality type. So, yeah, I can kind of understand why he didn't get a whole lot of movie roles, because if you're hiring Jim Nabors for a role, well, you're hiring Jim Nabors, pretty much, to do the shtick that got him on the Andy Griffith Show all the way back in the late 50s. Now, there's only a couple of supporting actors I want to touch on. There's several character actors you can catch in the movie. Generally, people who have done a lot of TV work in the 70s and 80s you might recognize. You know, a lot of actors, what I call the, oh yeah, that guy or that woman actors. But there's two I do want to touch on. One is the governor of Texas, who's played by Charles Durning, who I basically have known from a ton of serious roles, such as The Sting with Robert Redford, Dog Day Afternoon with Al Pacino, Sharky's Machine with Burt Reynolds. He's also appeared in Tootsie with Dustin Hoffman, the Hudsucker Proxy, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? But he's, like I said, this is a musical comedy, and I'm honestly trying to think, and I cannot think of another role where I get to see him sing and dance. And he's pretty good at it. In fact, according to one of the sites I researched it on, he was hired because Burt Reynolds wanted him to be in the film. The director originally wanted Mickey Rooney, and Burt Reynolds is reported to have said, well, people know Mickey Rooney can sing and dance. People don't know Charles Durning can do that. So if you put him in the movie, well, then you're going to, you know, be praised as the one who discovered, hey, Charles Durning can sing and dance. But the other character I kind of wanted to touch on, well, the other actor I wanted to touch on is the receptionist for the sheriff's office, who is played by Mary Jo Cutlett. And I'm not even going to list off any of her credits. She's a female character actor. She's been in a ton of things. But she is also, and you'll recognize this as soon as she answers the phone, she is the voice of Mrs. Puff on SpongeBob SquarePants. One of the funniest things I come across while researching this is the trouble they went through in trying to market the film. Because apparently in the early 80s, Whorehouse was not something that a lot of people wanted to have in their newspapers and on their television. And so they went through everything from renaming it in newspaper ads the best little cat house in Texas to just literally beeping the name in television commercials. So you could be, or on radio commercials. So you could hear this and be like, hey, it's Burt Reynolds, Dolly Parton, Dom DeLuise, and the best little beep in Texas. I mean, that's the way they marketed the film at the time, which just cracked me up. And in fact, they said Dolly Parton in interviews would refer to it as, I believe it was the best little cat house in Texas. Or I think a couple of the actors called it just referred to it as the chicken ranch. Like they was so many people caught up in, we can't call it a whorehouse. We can't promote the movie and use the word whorehouse, even though that's in our title of the film. I found that a little crazy when I was researching it. So what happened to the actual chicken ranch? Because in the movie and in real life, the moral crusading reporter won. But the original building itself was bought by a couple of investors who moved the entire structure to Dallas and then tried to reopen it as a restaurant in 1977 called the Chicken Ranch Restaurant. In fact, they actually roped in Miss Edna to play a hostess at the Chicken Ranch Restaurant. It closed less than a year later in 1978, and what's left of the Chicken Ranch, and from what I've seen of pictures, it's basically a condemned building. Like, there's been nothing done to maintain it over the years or restore it. According to one site I went to, they said they're trying to get it into the National Historical Registry, but I don't think there's enough of a building left for that to even be considered a structure anymore. And honestly, this is one of those films that for the time, it was very successful. I believe it grossed over $70 million at the box office. Had somewhere around a $30 million budget, if I remember right. I didn't write it down in my notes. So don't hold me to the budget exactly. But to have a movie this successful with like two of the biggest stars at the time, and it's pretty much forgotten nowadays, it's just kind of crazy to me. In fact, I tweeted the other day, if you guys follow me on Twitter, and why don't you? It's at C Fever Dreams. But I tweeted that while researching this film, I found a connection between this movie, the Alfred Hitchcock movie Psycho, as well as the Rob Zombie movie House of a Thousand Corpses. Now, I know you guys have heard of the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game. Well, this is kind of like that, except we're linking Alfred Hitchcock to Best Little Whorehouse in Texas to Rob Zombie. And it all involves the universe. It all involves the studio and the house itself. The lot that they built the exterior set on for all the outside shots is located on what was originally the Bates Motel, the house, the Psycho house, standing near the Bates Motel, is originally on that lot. So they moved the Psycho house, and they built the exterior sets for the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas in the early 80s. So you've got that house sitting on where the Psycho house used to be. And then you flash forward a couple of decades, and the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas ranch house gets roughed up and is the Firefly house in a House of a Thousand Corpses. Yeah, so there you go. There's a nice little icebreaker at parties. So let's get down to the most important question you can ask. Was it entertaining? Honestly, this was one of the most successful musical films of the 80s. It was the most successful musical of 1982. But on top of that, you got two stars at the height of their popularity that play well off of each other. You've added in a third person, that has a history with one of your main stars and who works well together. The script is witty. It plays to everybody's strengths. The music is very entertaining. It's you'll find yourself humming along with it, or a couple of days afterwards, maybe even remembering it and humming it, singing along with it. You've got Dolly Parton, one of the best voices, really, of the past century. Singing her heart out, putting the right amount of sass into the role and everything. All in all, it's one of those films that really I kind of started the podcast for. It's one of those films I cannot believe has kind of faded away and been forgotten about. I mean, okay, yeah, it's an R-rated comedy. Yeah, there's some nudity in it, both male and female. I will give you that much. There is sort of equal opportunity butts in this. But on top of that, it's a fun movie. You'll find yourself laughing. The songs are very entertaining. A great cast. All together, a really good package. It's a very entertaining film that I saw way too early in my life. Basically, I was 9 when it came out, 8 when it came out. But Yeah, it is one that I would recommend. If you're just looking for a fun movie to watch on a weekend or just pop in one night and just enjoy yourself, this is it. Good jokes, good times, good music, good package. It's a really fun movie. Go out, rent it, watch it. I rented it myself. This is June 2022. I rented it through Amazon for like $4. And yeah, strong recommendation for me. So next week we'll do Stockholm, I promise. I swear, there's nothing special about the number 70. And once again, I'll remind you that on the 17th of this month, I'm doing a crossover episode with Esoterica Cinema. You can go over to their podcast and pick it up as me and the guys from Esoterica talk about the 2020 movie The Show, written by and starring Alan Moore, the comic writer responsible for such things as the Swamp Thing revival in the 80s, Watchmen, V for Vendetta, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, also a practicing wizard for the past 30 plus years. But yeah, go over there, had a fun time. I know everything that we talked about did not make it into the episode just because when we got together, it was like a little over 3 hours of us just swapping stories and talking about the movie and a lot of off-topic stuff as well. But a lot of fun. And check them out anyway. Esoterica Cinema, a good bunch of guys. A bunch of guys. It's two of them. I don't know why I said bunch. Unless there's clones. Unless there's like six or seven of them, like in reserve, kind of like that role-playing game. What was it? Paranoia. We started out with six clones. And if you're lucky, at least one of them survived the character creation process. But either way, check out Esoterica Cinema, and I'll quit rambling here in a second. And don't forget, if you like what you heard, you could go out and tell a friend. If you didn't like what you heard, well, go out and tell an enemy. Either way, tell somebody. If the place you're listening to this from allows reviews or stars or what have you, please do so. It allows other people to find us. It pushes me into the algorithm. I'll quit talking about myself in the plural one day. But if you want to keep in touch with me, if you want to see some more of my random thoughts or send suggestions or corrections, what have you, you can find me on Twitter. I've already mentioned at Sea Fever Dreams. See me on TikTok at Celluloid Fever Dreams, Instagram at Celluloid Fever Dreams. You can follow me on Letterboxd. You can see what other movies I watch that I don't talk about that come out wrong. That's you know what I mean. I don't mean those kind of movies. Well, I mean, no, I don't mean. You can see the other films that I do watch that don't actually make it into episodes of the show over on Letterboxd at Wyndham Jennings, WYNDHAM. But either way, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Don't forget, you can be a lot of things in life. Kind is one of the better ones, especially to yourself. And I want to thank you for letting me be a little part of your week. Hope to see you here again next week. Until then, I have been Wyndham Jennings. This has been Celluloid Fever Dreams. Go out and find something interesting to watch. See you next time.